22nd of March, 1968. It is also a special meeting dedicated to the memory of Vice Admiral Pullman, who founded this club. And it is our custom to say a few words about her and the club before one introduces the speaker. Vice Admiral Pullman was born in Moscow in 1902. She received her certification in Moscow, but after her family left Russia, she started studying theology in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, in the was the first woman theologian graduated from that university. After that, she moved to Paris, where she took part in the work of the Russian Student Christian Movement, and was responsible for the youth work. After she married in 1928, Dr. Kuhlmann, who was a Swiss diplomat, philosopher, and theologian, and they have lived in various parts of Europe in connection with his work. Just before the war, they moved to London, where Dr. Kuhlmann was the Deputy High Commissioner for the Refugees, and after the war, Mrs. Kuhlmann, with some of her friends, started this Pushkin Club, which still is flourishing and continues the same work which was conceived at the beginning. The main task of this club is to provide a meeting place for people interested in Russia, and Mrs. Kuhlmann was always convinced that it is of great importance to have a place where people could speak freely and express their opinions and exchange their views. She was herself a very convinced Christian member of the Orthodox Church, but she always respected the opinions of others, and the club has been inspired by this idea of freedom. And from this point of view, it is particularly suitable that we have tonight our Orthodox Bishop, who will speak on freedom. I would like, before introducing the Bishop Wallace to you, also to mention how extraordinarily encouraging it is that this club continues its work, and the committee, which is responsible for this the program, has been very faithful to the original ideas laid down by Mrs. Kuhlmann. I can't avoid mentioning Mrs. Schutman and Mrs. Butler, who have done such a wonderful work for this club, and I think the club and all those who remember my sister owe a great debt to these two persons for the beneficial and devoted labors which they continue to do to this club. Now I must introduce the Metropolitan Anthony. It is not a very really suitable thing to introduce him, because I think most of you know him perfectly well, but I just will mention one or two facts from his biography. Metropolitan Anthony was born in Switzerland and in Lausanne. As a boy, he traveled intensely to Russia, to Iran, to Persia, to Mesopotamia. Eventually, he landed in Paris, where he received his medical training. and was there writing his doctor. Then in 1949, was invited by the Fellowship of St. Albans and St. Sergius to come over to England and to take part in the fellowship work. And soon he became the rector of the Rockham Parish in London. Then he became the bishop, the archbishop, and now he is metropolitan and exiled of the Moscow Patriarchate for the Western Europe. And the rest of what we think about his grace, I suppose you all know. And we are extremely grateful to him for his consent to come and address us on this particular night. And we appreciate so much that he is very busy over a church problem he has found the strength and, and wish to be with us tonight. Well, from what you have done with this letter,
from what you have just heard of my biography, you see, I'm certain with great clarity that I have absolutely no reason to be here and to speak on freedom. Nothing in my background gives me either a right or reason to do so. Dostoevsky says somewhere that one should speak either of things one knows or of things one likes. And as probably all the people who have no gift to give freedom to others, I like freedom. So this is the only reason why I feel I can speak about it. Nowadays, when people have thought out quite a great deal about freedom, and when science has progressed, it seems very often, and to many, that it is very difficult to speak of freedom at all. What amount of freedom is there which we really possess? And if you turn simply to the elementary thing of basic Christianity, to the fact that we were created and that we are all moving towards our judgment, that we do not make ourselves but are determined both by an act of God which gives us the nature which we possess, and by the, all the complexities which enrich, twist, change, and determine this nature in the course of life. It may appear that the theme of freedom is really a pure illusion. Indeed, we are called out of non-existence by a one-sided act of God. We exist because we are willed into existence. Once this has happened, we are in possession of a human nature which we have not chosen, a human nature which we have, for better or worse, inherited, already transformed, molded, changed by tens and hundreds of generations before us. And with all this, in the end, we are not in a position to contract out of things. We cannot at any moment simply say, I refuse to go on. I drop out of existence. We can indeed drop out of life, but we cannot cease to be. Even if we kill ourselves, we still have an objective, physical presence and reality. even if we could escape that physical presence and reality, not to speak of our eternal soul, we can never, under any circumstance, escape the fact that we have been. So that we are prisoners from every angle. We originate without any act of freedom on our part. We move inescapably towards an eternal existence, and all that we possess in order to become whatever we become is given and determines us. And so, to use an image which is far below these heights of speculation, we look tenderly like one of those insects which children catch and put under a glass or inside a glass. The insect moves forward and backward and around, and in whatever direction he goes, he finds the glass. The only thing, and this, at this point my analogy holds, I think, the only thing that the insect can do to escape is to fly, to move upwards, to go beyond those limitations which are the limitations of the glass, of the earthly conditionment. But this is not as simple to do in terms of freedom as it is perhaps for a winged insect to do in terms of escape. So that we come quite close to a vision of a tension between freedom and determination, in which determination is obvious, and in which freedom is anything but obvious. And if we recognize that freedom exists at all, and to this we'll come in a minute, it still remains that there is a problematic element in the whole thing, a problem to be solved, and something to understand about freedom, which is quite different from naive, candid assertions that where there is a will, there is a way, and that it's enough to want to be free in order to be free. That has been, I think, remarkably clear in the words of the Russian writer Chomyakov, who says that the divine will is freedom for his saints, the law for the unredeemed man, and damnation for the devil. And it is important for us to realize that it is the same and one divine will which is these three things. It can be freedom for the ones, it can be final and hopeless imprisonment for the others. It is a creative limitation for those in between. And now let us turn to freedom and try to think a little together about what that means. Usually, we define freedom in terms of choice, where there is no choice between two alternatives or number of possibilities, we do not recognize that there is freedom. And we are so accustomed to that, that it is rather rare that we realize that this freedom is already marred, that there is something wrong in this vision of freedom in terms of a choice, because every choice implies always a choice between life and death, good and evil, God and the devil. It may be a great deal of evil or little evil, a great deal of good or not much of it. But the alternative is always between plus and minus. And although it seems to us that to be able to choose without being determined, conditioned from the outside, indifferently, according to our whim, is freedom, in reality, it is already an aspect of enslavement and adulteration of our very nature. Because if instead of speak of good and evil, which are big words and which do not give us a clear image of what they mean, we think in terms of concrete good and evil, health and illness. For instance, isn't it obvious that equanimity, indifference in the choice, the ability to choose for illness as freely as one chooses for health, in itself speaks of the fact that we are profoundly wounded by some sort of lack of integrity. And this is made extremely clear in the Greek Septuagint version of the Bible, in, I think, the 7th chapter of Isaiah, which is read on the eve of Christmas in Orthodox churches. It is applied to the Lord Jesus Christ. And the passage reads as follows. A child will be born who, before he can distinguish good from evil, will have chosen the good. At this point, you may say, there is no freedom, because there was no wavering, no hesitation, no indifference to either. On the other hand, you can say, this is the only healthy situation, because a healthy moral structure, as a healthy organism, as a healthy society, does not indifferently vacillate between life and death, between destruction and building, between integrity or disintegration. It goes to what is integrity against disintegration, life against death, good against evil, God against the devil. So that this definition of freedom in terms of a choice, which is determined by no inner law, which is an unconditioned choice, and which is as legitimate one way or the other, is not a definition of freedom, of the freedom, of a healthy moral or physical organism. To be indifferent to the possibility of disintegration or to the possibility of life is already adulteration of the system. So that, although in practice, in the life which we lead, our freedom expresses itself continuously in acts of choice, in acts of approximation, in situations in which we are in a state of tension, being attracted in one direction and called in the other, it still remains that this is not a sufficient definition of what freedom is, of that we spend our life wavering in one direction or another. God calls, the devil beguiles. And we have within ourselves these two laws of which St. Paul speaks, of which one wars against the other. But this inner war, this civil war within ourselves, is already a state of lack of integrity, of lack of harmony. Those who have already heard me speak know probably that I have an unhealthy passion for semantics and for trying to find the meaning of things in the meaning of words. And so I will indulge in this exercise at your expense now, and try to find out or to define a little what freedom is. Now, it is impossible to define the meaning of a concept by holding to one language and to the way in which a word is used in the 20th century. So I would like to look into the meaning of three words: liberty, freedom, and the Russian word svoboda, which means these two, the same thing. The Latin word libertas is a lawyer's expression, apart from being an expression drawn out of the concrete social situation. Early Latin society knew slaves and free men, and in terms of children, it knew children born in free families and children born in slaves. The child born in a free family was free by birthright. He was called a liber. The child born in a slave's family was called a puer. He was a child in a general sense, but he could never accede to the term of liber. And this is important, because if you think now of what that implies, first of all, on the level of human relationships in society, and then if you extrapolate to what it means in terms of divine human relationship, you will find that a liber is a child who is free by birthright, but whose freedom is not guaranteed by birthright. Because in all these societies divided in slaves and free people, the slaves were not always original slaves. They belonged to conquered nations, to defeated neighbors. People could fall down and come down in society and become slaves. So that the freedom was not defined simply by the fact that you were born free, but by the fact that you were capable of defending your freedom and of being a free man. And this applies in law in a certain way, but internally it applies also to those who were socially slaves, to which I will come in a moment. So that this child born free must, in order to become capable of being a free man, receive a free man's education. This free man's education consists in training him in such degree of mastery that he is lives. And we see that so well in feudal society in the West, as we can see it in Roman society in the first centuries of Roman life. This implies and argues a strict education in self-mastery, which is the only way of reaching freedom. So that, from the point of view of a child who is to be made a free man, his life at home is one of the most strenuous forms of enslavement. He will never be allowed to go slack, to be weak, to be overcome and possessed and ruled by passion. He will be trained in mastery, which begins by discipline and obedience. Now, we are accustomed, when we speak of discipline, to think in terms of military drill. Discipline to us is the state in which we are when an outer, more powerful, more exacting will has authority to make us do what we do not wish to do. But this is a derived form of the meaning. Originally, this discipline is rooted in the idea of the disciple, or the one who is being taught. And discipline is primarily the state of one who becomes someone's disciple, who wishes to be taught and trained, and who therefore submits to the other, to someone who is not an outer will in the sense in which a non-commissioned officer is an outer will and an authority and the power over the private soldier. He submits to the outer will because he sees in his master what he wishes to become, and in order to become what his master is like, he is prepared to be molded by him. St. Thomas Aquinas says somewhere that we cannot learn anything unless we are prepared to obey our master, because we must very often learn the meaning of things after the moment we have learned the things themselves. We cannot, and particularly in the spiritual or in the intellectual life, first get things explained and then do them. We must first, very often, learn to do things in an act of surrender in order to know them from the inside and discover in them a significance and a meaning which could not be conveyed from the outside. So that we discover at this point that if this liber wants to possess his freedom, which was given him at the outset, but which he can lose by the simplest accident of political or social life, he must learn discipline and mastery, and that the way to learn it is obedience, submission, or rather surrender, so that through listening to a master, he discovers first what he's taught, and then beyond the words and the gestures that convey to him what he is to do and what he is to learn, he must discover the meaning of things and become capable of perceiving not only the words and the signs, but the intention and the spirit and the meaning of things. This way of becoming free then can we be free if we are prepared to surrender our infantile liberty to a will which is mature, which is well-intentioned, to someone who is to us an image. And if you transfer this terminology, which you can see very clearly exemplified in early Roman life, to the relationship between man and God, we discover something which is extremely important. That indeed, God, with regard to us, is like the pater familias with regard to the leader in the family. But exactly in the same way, ideally, he is not an outer authority. He is a perfect image. He is a terminal ad quem, something towards which we move, and not a power that crashes us from heaven downwards. We are not called to become slavish, and slavishly subjected to God. We are called to be trained by Him in order to grow into that freedom which will make us truly, really, God's own children. Now, this relationship, this situation, is possible only if there is something else to it than authority in the modern sense of the word, that is, overwhelming power, or a power that can determine our life, our situation, and at times our being against our will, whether this will is good or ill. And this indeed is brought forth very forcibly in the meaning of the English word freedom, of the German word Freiheit, and the words which are connected with the same Saxon and Germanic roots. Because at the root of the word freedom, there is a word which spells F-R-A-E, and which I will not dare pronounce either in English or in any other language, because one never knows what happens to letters when they become English words, which in the time when it was used did not mean simply a free person. It meant beloved, preceded by my or mine. It meant my beloved. And it is only in this relatedness of the beloved and the lover that freedom was conceived, both in Germanic and in Anglo-Saxon roots. This leads us just one step further from what I said before about libertas, because it brings into focus what is at the very heart of what I try to convey, that all these things become true and creative only if there is this spark, which is love. And if we go back to the word libertas in connection with freedom, you will realize that if the one who determines, the one whose disciples we are, the one whom we obey, the one to whom we surrender, because we are both loved and, however incipiently, loving, then the whole process must result in our becoming to the full, in as perfect a way as is possible for us, all that we can be And there is a study made by in one of Chernikov's linguistic essays on the meaning of the Russian word svoboda, which underlines the fact that it is rooted in two words, which means to be oneself. But to be oneself does not imply opposition or contrast. It implies even less choice and indifferent choice. To be oneself is something which is beyond comparison, because we are not ourselves simply because we are different from others. There is a point beyond which being different or not does not make sense. Being different defines what also in theology calls an individual. Being ourselves defines what also in theology would call the person. I know that the word person is now submitted to complicated analysis, but I would like simply to explain what it means. An individual, from the simple meaning of the word, is the last term of fragmentation. It is that thing which can no longer be divided, in the same sense in which an atom is what cannot be cut in twain or divided further. When we say that so and so is an individual, we simply assert that in this complex fragmentation of mankind, of nations, of races, of churches, or whatever, one cannot go dividing farther without losing the integrity of the thing. If you try to divide me beyond what you see here, the final result will be a corpse and a departed soul. But it will not be me in any workable and any earthly sense. So that the individual is a term of fragmentation, the last, one cannot go farther, and any it is a term of fragmentation of something which is a whole, it possesses characteristics that belong to the whole. Only grouped together, adjusted together in a way that makes us recognizable. Each of us has size, volume, color, sounds differently, and so forth. But these are common characters which don't belong to any one of us in particular. You can find my voice elsewhere, you can find someone else's face elsewhere, and so forth. The person is something much more elusive than this. It is elusive because it has reality, but it cannot be simply pinned down and defined in terms of contrast or of opposition. The person ultimately is what in each of us is unique, unrepeatable, which exists only once and is not differentiated from others because its characteristics are grouped differently from the characteristics of another person, but because there is no such thing as each of us. It is made clear or conveyed by an image which you find in the book of Revelation, in which we are told that those who will belong to the kingdom of God will receive each of them a white stone with a name written on it, which, says the book, no one knows except God and him who will receive it. This signifies that the name written on it is not just the nickname by which we are known practically, John, Peter, or Mr. So-and-so, or Mrs. So-and-so, which could be multiplied by infinity without making any difference. The name of which the book speaks is that name which coincides exactly with all that we are, which is identical, if you want, with we are. And if you wish to use imagination and not scripture as such, we could say it could very well be the name by which God called us out of radical absence to posit us in existence. Whatever the case, it signifies that between this person and God, there is a relatedness which is unique and unrepeatable. And not only unique and unrepeatable, but incommunicable. I can know who I am and what I am, because God knows. But no one else can, because if we could know one another the way we are known of God, we would be identical with each other. And in that sense, not only our unicity would no longer exist, we would not exist at all anymore. In those terms, to be oneself in the full, perfect sense, not of a germinal possibility, but of a completely blossomed out reality, is freedom, svoboda. If you think out these different terms which I have tried to go through, you will see that although in practice freedom can be defined in terms of a hesitating, approximative choice, ultimately, freedom is a relationship between us and God, between us and each other. And a relationship which is not yet freedom, but is becoming free in this process of becoming the children of God, of becoming beloved and loving in response, of becoming ourselves as we have been invented, thought out, and caused to be by God Himself. You may say that this is a very poor freedom in the end, because if all the freedom I can possess consists in discovering what I have got to be immediately, hopelessly, and saying that that's what I am, it may be a consoling freedom, but no freedom in the true sense. It wouldn't be freedom in the true sense if something else did not happen to fulfill this quest of ours. And what can fulfill this quest of ours is a true relationship of sonship and fatherhood with the one who has willed us into existence and who wants us not only to be ourselves in a creaturely limited way, but who has called us to become partakers of the divine nature, who has called us to be, by participation, thanks to participation, begotten Son is. And if we see our vocation in becoming that participation what God is, then the ultimate point of freedom is such integration into the divine freedom itself, that we become free with the freedom of God himself. Well, I think this is enough as an introduction on the subject. I have not touched at all and intentionally on the question of evil, but I think that the question of freedom in itself is big enough and can be discussed.
Thank you very much for this introduction. And now the meeting is open to any questions or comments which you would like to make, and I hope we will make good use of this time which the Metropolitan has given us tonight. I would like to raise this question which you mentioned, namely for the extraordinary uniqueness of all of us. I think there is something really striking that in this enormous cosmos in which we live, and in which we know the elements are all the same in this unimaginable space which it occupies, when we come to human beings or to any biological creature, then the difference appears. And I was just struck a few days ago talking to a man from the Scotland Yard, who said to me that even a hair of each human being is completely unique and unrepeatable. And when they have collection of the hairs of the different criminals, they can never be confused. I mean, it's so fantastic that no two human beings are really the same hair. I just wondered how that affects our freedom. You said that in some ways we receive the freedom of God, and that in that way each of us becomes this completely unique person. And but would you say that this freedom is entirely our relation to God? To what extent, for instance, we exercise this freedom towards our material world? Are we entirely sort of enslaved in the material world, and are we only free, as you said, as you said, only flying outside of this world towards God, then we receive freedom?
First of all, to start with the insect, I never say that it flies towards God. I simply meant that the only way he has to get out of his glass is to fly upwards, and that takes nearly about 5 inches probably, and does not imply all the way Godwards. And it's not simply silly to reply and deal with things at the moment. There is between his movement upwards and its completion in God all the space there is in time and in the three-dimensional world. We are determined in a way, and we determine in another way, even in the most ordinary sense. We are determined by our surroundings. This is a common place. But we also determine our surroundings even if we seem to be completely determined. Someone who is simply like a doormat seems to be completely enslaved, determined, and yet those who treat him as a doormat are affected by that, own small than he is. He can be very well, he can very well be treated as a doormat and remain free, while the one who treats him that way certainly deteriorates. I have meant at a certain point to underline the fact that a change of social condition is not always a change from freedom to slavery. And I was thinking of Epictetus, for instance, who had been a free man in Greece, became a slave, and yet was the head of a Stoic school of thought. And he was a man of immense freedom, although, from a social point of view, he was a slave. So that we are both determined and determining. As far as the physical world is concerned, and our physical personality is concerned, I think there are things which one can say with a certain amount of objectivity. I think a great deal more can be said in an imaginative way. You know, you remember this passage in the Gospel in which we are told that we will be answered for every vain, empty word which we pronounce. Well, it seems to be verging on the absurd. What's wrong in saying all these words that are quite useless, but don't really harm anyone very much? I was then thinking about 10 years ago by an article in a newspaper or in a magazine concerning infrasounds, a laboratory that worked on acoustics and produced inaudible sounds. And to begin with, everything was quite all right. It was the most charming and pleasant neighbors to have in a laboratory. No noise, nothing was produced, they just did things, and they inscribed by complicated gadgets sounds that no one could perceive, until people began to worry, because it was in the United States, the skyscrapers around began to shake, because these sounds which could not be heard could shake masses of cement, of stone, and so forth. Now, from what we know of the most primitive physics, we know that once you have set a wave moving, it never stops moving. And one can very well, very conceivably think that when you bark at someone with all the animosity there is in you, this sound wave hits the victim very often, very slightly. If he used to your bad temper, he will probably shrug his shoulders and wait for the end of it. But the sound that you have thrust out is going throughout everything the world is made of. And we do not know the effect of it. I don't mean to say that I have a physical theory about it, but then there is no less reason to think in those terms than to ignore the fact. On the other hand, if we have got a spiritual reality within ourselves, it is not difficult to trace at least certain ways in which it affects us outwardly. You know very well what the faces of people are according to mood, accidental mood, or more or less continuous mood. You know very well how faces change in a person who lives for greed, for hatred, for envy, or people who live determined by other feelings, the beauty of the one, the ugliness of the other, and so forth. And if that is so simple and so evident, I think if the portrait of Dorian Gray is the thing that we can see around us continuously, then why not suppose that our inner identity can determine us more and more in every detail? That could lead us into other discussions about identity or lack of identity. But in principle, it is conceivable, and I don't see why a face can be molded in the course of years to the point of changing totally from childhood to old age by the violence of passion or the harmony of harmonious states, and say, Nicholas Hare was not determined by his spiritual condition to be unique for Scotland Yard.
Yes. I was very interested in your semantic discussion. Libertas and Deschutes, does it mean that I become the disciple of somebody and thereby I get my freedom, my libertas? But what if I become the disciple of somebody else who has completely opposing views to this other person? Does the nature of my freedom change with it?
If you give yourselves into the discipline of someone who aims at making you in his own image, indeed, yes. But if you give yourself to someone who is worthy of being called, a master in any way, his aim will not be to make you a reflection of him, but to bring you to what you truly are. I remember a saying by a French novelist called Henri Fauconnier in a remarkable book, that Malaisie, in which a man says to another, remember that all that a master can do for a disciple is to bring him to himself, himself being the disciple, say. And he adds, the way may be so long. So that any teacher, if he is worthy of being a teacher at all, will try to make you into what you are and not what he is. So that you can go to people who are profoundly different if they have the respect for what you are and are not trying to manufacture a certain type of people for a certain type of purpose, they will lead you to the same place. Of course, there will be nuances, but it will be the same line. They will lead you inward and not to any image which will be an alter image.
Sir, a recent competition of poetry organized by the Ukrainian League was won by two poems submitted by an Englishwoman. These poems were on the subject. They had to be a matched pair of poems, and they were on the subject. The first poem, Freedom, and the second poem, of Captivity. The two poems which won the competition described identical facts. What a person did on getting up in the morning. This person's activities included going through a garden gate and walking across a meadow. The freedom in this one particular tableau I referred to was the wide meadow with no hedges, that could be walked across in any direction, with beautiful nature, the sun, the animals all around. The captivity was all that sort of imagined things by spoiling the dew. It was more powerfully put across in his poem than I could put across now, but it was very powerfully put across in the one poem. The identical activity was very, very free and very beautiful. And in the other one, the same identical activity was particularly awkward from moral and other points of view. Another poem was written by a prisoner in a New York jail who described very movingly the freedom of having no bills to pay, of having no wife to reply that he hadn't darned his socks, of having no problems with school fees, of having no problems with meals, of having no problems of remembering when to do things, because everything he had to do he was told him to do. You spoke, sir, of the desirability of retaining the position of a leader. What is wrong in retaining the freedom and the humility of someone who has no power, who has no one whose respect he must maintain?
If I understood rightly, I think there is nothing wrong in retaining any form of freedom provided you are really free. That is, provided your freedom is not an escape out of one system of conditioning into a more secure system in which you are perfectly conditioned, but in a way that hurts you less. See, one of the things in which we feel trapped almost all the time is responsibility. To escape responsibility into what one could call the womb position, back to the womb, it may be a boarding school, it may be a prison, it may be a definite situation, say, in something like the army, in which you know exactly where you stand, and you are shielded about from every angle and so forth, may be a trap in that respect. On the other hand, unconditioned freedom, with just one thing lacking, may be the most cruel mockery of freedom. I think at present about an essay, I can't remember where, of Sartre, in which he introduces the subject of freedom by saying, here is a man who has lost his job. All his life is late, got up and so forth, all you can imagine. And now he's free. He can go anywhere he wants. He can use his time anywhere, any way he chooses, etc. The only thing he cannot do is to have a job. And the only thing that results is that he throws himself under a tree. So that you can't define freedom simply by without reference. I felt blissfully free when I was in the army, because I hadn't any desire to do any of the things which I was supposed to do, and I felt totally irresponsible. I remember with a sense of heavenly delight a morning when I heard the lieutenant tell the corporal that we should dig trenches from north to south, and the corporal telling us that we should dig them from east to west. Well, I said nothing because I didn't care at all whether they were north, south, east, west, or in all directions. All I knew is that I earned 25 centimes a day anyhow. I knew that
the weather was cold but good, and the digging was a nice exercise. I was absolutely sure that the war would never be won by my trench. So I dug and dug and dug for a couple of hours, 3 I think, until the corporal came and abused me with all the richness and favor of the army for not having understood that it should be north to south. But I felt absolutely free, it didn't hurt me. Because it was the same delight to feel the trench and to start the blood of the army. Well, you see, in that sense, you can't say I had an experience of freedom. In reality, it was not freedom. It was that I had escaped a kind of involvement, which I disliked. You know, being responsible and having to be answerable and so forth, into a blissful situation of total indifference and irrelevance. But on the other hand, if you are thrown simply into the void, do whatever you want, you discover that you are not free anymore. So that all that carries together in a way. And what the examples you gave, the first one about the way in which two people can do two things which are identical objectively, that is, you from the outside, and so to the outside, as perceived, is so obvious. You can have a delightful long stroll, but when you do a march, you feel differently. But on the other hand, when you have outgrown these comparatively low levels into greatness, then again you are no longer either a slave or a free man, because socially you can be one thing, inwardly you can be another. I mentioned Epictetus before. He was a slave, yet he was sovereignly free of hatred, of fear, of passion, while his master, who was cruel and violent, was totally enslaved. But I don't know, I can't answer better this is what he said.
Would you say a little louder?
Yes.
Or would you get up, please?
Oh, well, what I wanted to say was I'd be very interested to hear a dissertation on habit. Because to some extent, a habit is a useful thing. It makes the time that we have as our own something we can enjoy. You know, certain things can be done without our having to think about them. But in other respects, habit can make us enslaved to the pattern of the habit. This is a great problem in the question of how to live a good life, how much you should be a creature of habit, and how much you should escape from habit in order to be freer, rise upwards like the insect in the grass, trying to rise upwards.
Well, habit, like so many things, is an equivocal thing, is an ambiguous situation. Because indeed it gives us a great deal of freedom of mind or even of physical freedom. Say, when we have transformed something into automatic reactions, we can busy ourselves with a lot of things at the same time. Say, a child who begins to walk must walk with his intelligence. And he cannot use his intelligence to any purpose while he is walking. The moment we have learned to walk, we climb stairs, we run up and down, we can even cross streets without particular intellectual exertion, because all the things are there in automatic reaction. And there are so many things which are much more elaborate, which we do thanks to habit and thanks to
transforming certain things in reflexes, some things into automatic movement, and so on. But I think we must train ourselves to use our habits, but not to allow them to possess us. I don't mean to say that you must periodically climb your staircase thinking of what you do, because usually if you do, it ends rather badly, because we are no longer capable of doing that by intellectual exercise. But I will give you another example. When you learn things by heart, to begin with, it is difficult to retain them. Then a moment comes when you can trot them out absolutely freely. But you will become master of your automatism when you can recite something, interrupt it, intersperse it with something else, and go on. For instance, when you can, well, I'll give you an example which is personal in a way. I know a certain amount of church prayers by heart. But when I pray with people, I usually don't use one prayer after the other. I try to build a prayer which meets the present situation, also bits taken here and there, so that I would start with this, drop it here, take from there, and so forth. You can do this only if you know them by heart to perfection. But if you know them by heart only to the point of being able to say the second word on condition that the previous word was said, you are not free of your own automatism. And that is the kind of training one must give oneself, to be able to use one's instruments, intellectual or other, and yet not be determined by them. When someone says, I can't do this or that anymore because I'm used to doing it otherwise, it's an unfolded statement. Now, practically, it may be a convenient thing and an expedient thing. It may be very convenient, for instance, to train generations of people into certain kinds of specialized automatism because it improves production. But that is not a way of making people into people, unless you give them a counterpart in other ways. So that habit has these two aspects which you mentioned, but I think they can meet the moment you have acquired the habit and then taken possession of it so that you can either use it or check it completely. And I'm not obviously speaking of things like walking up and down staircase or writing or doing that kind of thing, but more elaborate things in which we introduce mechanisms. Did I answer at all?
Committed in the name of freedom. I don't know who said it. And
Madame Roland.
And I think it's open to so many interpretations. Anyhow, so many definitions of freedom I read that it would take a book but one which was very seldom quoted. And I wonder what would be the opinion. It's very simple, but very little known in Europe, Mexico, freedom by the Benito Juarez. Said your freedom ends where the freedom of your neighbor begins. And that was the whole definition of always political philosophy, and more or less the battle cry for 20 years of fighting around in the 1860s, 1860s.
Well, on this level, this is of course applied freedom. I mean, social freedom, relational freedom. And at the root of it, as far as misuse is concerned, little duty. And the corrective which you mentioned is only a practical corrective, which doesn't really imply the recognition of the rights of the other or of your duty to him, but the fact that it does not work if you do not accept these limitations, because you will have a headlong clash with someone else's rights. This is a sort of bad balance which is reached in societies or in nations or in groups when power politics is applied, and when one does not do the wrong thing simply because one knows what the consequences will be. But this is not a way of reaching any kind of inner freedom, because the impulse is still there, the assertiveness is there, the assertion that I have rights and unfortunately you exist and I must take you into account is there. I don't think, I have no experience of things in terms of law and of, say, crime or social tensions. But this is the impression I have. The moment you say that I must take into account someone else's freedom, the word must shows that you are quite unwilling, and if you could avoid it, you would. But it's expedient, it's less dangerous, it's good for the general balance of society, but it would be nice if one could work it out differently. And that's not very
pleasant. Okay, we've listened obviously with great interest, and it seems that we've come to, you've pointed in the direction of freedom. You have also, in the course of your talk, described several conditions of freedom. We could very well conceive of a random crossing of the street in traffic as a form of freedom. Yet it would not be worthwhile, not because of the risk, but simply the content of this freedom would not be sufficient. You have also told us that in the past, to gain freedom, people became disciples and were taught by the master to be themselves. So, in effect, you have implied that the key to freedom lies in the phrase, know thyself. What could you say further to this point?
I think I would like, first of all, to underline what you said in the beginning, that it isn't only a balance of power that should limit our freedom, but the recognition that there are contents of freedom which are so ridiculous that one should not use freedom in this shallow and absurd way. Anarchical use of freedom simply for the sake of I want to do what I want to do is an absurdity. Now, I reason from, of course, from a given angle, because all of us do, however we try to be honest in what we say. And I think what I said implies that at the root of things there is know yourself, because unless you know yourself, you will not come to being yourself. There is a point at which, unless you have understanding, you will lose your way, or you will just stop halfway. But when I used the word master, I was thinking in rather diffuse terms, because the word can mean, if I, can have a concreteness which is quite different in the various religious or philosophical schools. Say, an Indian guru is also a master, a university a teacher can be also a master according to his own way and so forth. But in the absence of someone who can concretely take me in hand, be for me a revelation, guide me in discipleship, in obedience, and in freedom, I think for the Christian, there is one who said about himself, don't call anyone master, I am the only master, and so forth. I mean, you remember this passage. And it isn't only because he had all knowledge and all wisdom and so forth. It is because, and this is essential to mastery and to the position of the master, he is one in whom one can see what one is to achieve. The Lord Jesus Christ, to me, is not simply one who teaches. He is one who is, with an extraordinary complexity, richness, and simplicity, the term towards which each of us can go in order to reach his own, not his Christ's image. In that sense, I think it's important for us to stand very definitely and clearly on the old faith that Christ is very God and very man. Not only very God, but that he is truly, in the most realistic sense, the only one whom one can call a real and true man. With the implication that one isn't a real and true man unless one is rooted in Godhead. And this search for oneself, apart from the ways in which I have implied it and you have implied it, implies also, and also has a part as a culminating point, what St. Paul calls, I can't remember now the quotation well, either finding Christ in self or self in Christ, which is in a way the same thing, viewed from two angles. There is a, that would be too long simply to speak about, that would be a subject for a complete discussion. But there is a way in which, there are ways rather, in which we can discover our true self in Christ and vice versa. The sort of basic assumption for a Christian would be probably this, that to speak in a pictorial way, that we are all images of him in the way in which portraits are images of the original. But all of us, we are portraits that have been tampered with in the most ruthless way. And the first problem which we have when we are confronted with a painting which bears the marks of generations of people who have repaired it, improved it, corrected it, and so on, is to settle down and try to find which are the few original features which belong to the hand of the original master. And from then onwards, begin to clear all the other successive layers of faith. And this is what is essential for us, whether we have a human guide or whether our guide is God revealed as man. It's a matter of discovering gradually the few points we have in common with true humanity. And going further and further in this discovery, clearing the ground more and more, until we have a more and more, or a less and less approximative image, until we approximate more and more the original. I think that is something which can be done without any sort of master-disciple relationship when there is no master, because masters cannot be simply chosen at random. It's not a function that makes one capable of helping another to find himself. There must be insight, there must be, I don't know what really, but there is something that does. Did I answer at all what you said?
Well, it'll take me a long time to take all this in, so I'll come back.
You have drawn to us very vividly the imperfection of our state in relation to the freedom, our wavering, and yet, of course, it is amazing how every human being is thirsty for freedom. And to me, the ripple of Ethereum, the real promise of a real freedom, is in Christ, because he has called us to perfection. And it's only imperfection that can be freedom. But in this understanding of freedom, that it is striving to perfection, in a practical everyday life, our choice, our wavering, imperfect wavering, when it is moral, striking, when our conscience can tell us, it is easier. But so often our decisions are about indifferent things. I could stay in Oxford and do dozens of useful things.
The recording ended here.